and called my grandmother on Thursday evening. And my aunt answered the phone. I thought it was my grandmother. Their voices have grown together over the years. And I caught up with my aunt for a second, and she asked if they might call me back, because they were just getting ready to sit down for dinner. My grandparents were an enormous part of my childhood experience and made such an impression on my life that carries through today in a quite significant way. That particular set of grandparents came together with, I guess, a small measure of eccentricity in that they were married in 1972 when I was 2 years old, my grandfather being my mother's father, and my grandmother being, for me, just my grandmother. I guess technically she is my step-grandmother, but I have never known a day, at least in my own consciousness, without Mary Carolyn as my grandmother. And I called her on Thursday evening in order to wish her a happy 103rd birthday. I know. She still lives by herself in her own home in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And, it's a little fragile. It's just like, it is what it is. But once you get to three digits, I feel like you just get to do what you want to do. And that is the reality. She does wear a little button around her neck in case something goes wrong. And occasionally something does go wrong. But for the most part, it's a very beautiful existence. When my grandparents were married, they each sold houses and they combined resource and bought the house that I remember going to as a child several times a year. And I have so many happy memories that took place under that roof, particularly in their living room. Because of the fact that they were married in 1972, and I assume bought that house in 1972, my granddad was in the energy sector in Tulsa. The house is fairly fancy, but fancy like in like quintessential 70s way. They had this giant living room with a big fireplace, and in one corner, there was a spiral staircase. That went up to this balcony. The walls were coated with wood paneling, dark brown wood paneling, and the flooring in the living room, the flooring was brown and gold shag carpeting, wall to wall. And at least once or twice a week, Laura, the housekeeper, had this plastic rake where she would rake the shag carpeting so that it would look nice for like 45 seconds before there was a trail trodden through the shag carpeting. And one of my favorite things about this living room and spending time with my grandparents was sitting on a particular spot on their couch, which was mine, facing my grandfather who had his chair. My grandfather had his chair, and my grandmother had her chair, and my grandfather's chair was, for the most part, a throne. You did not sit in my grandfather's chair when my grandfather was in the house, but when he left the house, you tried it on. You were like, does it fit? Will it fit someday? And I would sit on my particular spot on the couch, my grandfather in his chair, and I would listen to him share stories of his childhood and his young adulthood and his midlife. He was a captivating storyteller and would tell stories with these vivid details, and I'm sure I like sat on the edge of the couch, leaning in, listening to these marvelous stories. My grandfather had somewhat of a tough childhood. And my favorite story of my grandfather's to some degree narrates some of the tragedy of his childhood. He was the eldest of three children, born in Ranger, Texas in 1910. Ranger is a little town in West Texas, just west of Fort Worth, if you know the state of Texas. And the first picture that I've ever seen of my grandfather, I mean, the first picture that was taken of my grandfather, he is in my grandmother Virginia's arms, and my grandmother Virginia is sitting on the bench on a wagon, a horse-drawn wagon. So he grew up to some degree in the Wild West. He was the eldest of three children. He had a middle sister and a little brother. His mom, Virginia, was a homemaker, and his dad, Henry, was an artist. And in most of his father's artwork was relegated to the way that he made ends meet with his art was that he painted like the front of greeting cards. My grandfather was also a rugged alcoholic. And to be clear, not a benign one. Alcohol and the disease of addiction turned him into a violent monster like it does for some of us. And my grandfather grew up in a house where his father was physically abusive, both to his mother and to him and his siblings. Now, to look at me, you wouldn't expect it, but my grandfather was a big guy, a somewhat imposing figure. At young adulthood, he played football for the University of Oklahoma, which is kind of a bummer, but I turned that around by going to the University of Texas. Dark chapter in our family history that has been redeemed. But my grandfather was a big guy, and when he reached the age of 12, he was big enough, and he told this story, this favorite story of mine. He told me that when he was 12 years old, it occurred to him that if he were to stay in their family home, that at some point, one day or another, either he would kill his father or his father would kill him. And so at 12 years old, he left his family home and went to roughneck in the oil fields of West Texas. Now, details are somewhat important. You should probably know that he wasn't like, you know, he didn't have like a stick with a bandana and a few things tied up on the end of it, all on his lonesome. He went to move close by to an aunt and uncle who oversaw the rest of his childhood for, to some degree. But because of the size of their family, he was not able to live under their roof. And so when he made it to their house, they found a way for him to work in the oil fields. And while he was working in the oil fields, he was able to live in a bunkhouse on a ranch in West Texas. And when my grandfather was taken to this ranch where he was to live in the bunkhouse, he assumed that he would be living in the bunkhouse with other roughnecks working in the West Texas oil patch. But when he arrived there, he was told that the bunkhouse would be his alone. All the other roughnecks that worked in this particular part of the oil patch lived in their family homes with their wives and their children. And so my grandfather moved into this bunkhouse where he lived by himself as a 12-year-old. Each morning he would make breakfast for himself, get dressed, and a pickup truck would come pick him up and drive him to the oil patch. And then That pickup truck would take him to the bunkhouse at the end of the day, where he would enter and find his supper on a plate under a napkin waiting for him. And this was his life as a 12-year-old, day in and day out, until he was about 17 years old. Sometimes in the evenings, because he was a good athlete, he played baseball in a like oil patch baseball league. But for the most part, he spent most of his childhood alone. He told me in this favorite story that every Friday, at the end of the day, when he was paid, he would come home and he would grab, he had one pair of nice pants that he wore to church every Sunday. And he would come home and he would take his Sunday pants off the hanger, put them on the table, and he would carefully unstitch a portion of the hem on his pants. He would put his week's pay in the hem and then sewed the hem back up, because he was afraid that while he was gone from the bunkhouse working in the oil patch during the day, that someone would come in and steal all of his money. He didn't have a bank account, and so he was forced to hide the resource that he made as a teenage roughneck working in the West Texas oil patch. He told me the story that one night while he was in bed, he was awakened in the middle of the night. And he always said that part of the reality of living in the bunkhouse was that he lived with just a measure of fear. He told me one night he awakened in the middle of the night to a man walking on the porch, on the wooden planks of the porch, clip-clop, clip-clop, walking back and forth across the front porch. And he knew that that man walking on the front porch in the middle of the night was either there to steal his money or to do him harm. And so my grandfather sat there, terrified, underneath his blankets, wondering what to do. Finally, he hatched a plan. He decided that when he surmised that that man walking back and forth across the front porch reached the open window, that particular aspect of the front porch, that he would throw off his bed covers, dive through the window, and attack this man who meant to either rob him or do him harm. Clip, clop, clip, clop. This man walking back and forth on his front porch. At one point, my grandfather surmised that that man was directly in front of the open window. He threw off his blankets, dove through the open window, tackled the man, put his arm around his neck, and began to beat him. As he told the story, he said each time his fist landed, he heard the man go, "Ooh." And my grandfather said, "I just kept pounding him until he stopped going, ugh." When the man stopped making the noise, my grandfather came to consciousness, released him, and found that he had been frightened by and he had been beating a calf from the ranch. Somebody asked me after the 8 o'clock service, "What happened to the calf?" And I was like, these stories were told to me in the 70s, before we had a sensitivity about what might be happening to the animal. And they were in Texas, on a ranch. Context, people, right? My grandfather had dozens of stories like that that narrated the experience that he had as a child. And those experiences told tales of the highest highs and the lowest lows. They were born out of such fantastic adventures that for the most part, we in North America no longer live. And I sat on the edge of that couch listening to every single one of those stories again and again and again throughout the entirety of my childhood. Now, I could tell you also that I had a high school college sweetheart, and she and I dated long enough that she came with me to visit my grandparents many times, and she was also at home in Houston. My grandparents lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I grew up in Houston, Texas, and so this girlfriend that I had spent many evenings listening to my grandfather's stories. And one time, after my grandparents had left, I think they had been visiting us in Texas, and after my grandparents left, my girlfriend turned, and she said something to me that I know was meant to be a compliment. And she said, "You know, Jimmy, like, it's so amazing that I see you, like, sitting there listening to your granddad tell these stories over and over and again. And I've only been a part of your family for a few years, and he tells the same stories over and over again. And I see you sitting on the edge of the couch, listening to those stories as if it is the first time that you have ever heard them." And I was like, "Oh, you think that stories are about plot and characters and details, but they are not. This story that I have told you and the stories of my grandfather's life narrated trauma and abuse and violence and grit and resilience and post-trauma growth, and they always had a measure of good humor. You think that stories are about plot and character and detail, but stories are about living, how we really live, and how we invite meaning and purpose into our lives. And I don't know why I was afforded the great privilege of being oriented to this reality that we have in our human universe, this reality that we have where stories are revelation. But I have always been captivated by stories, so much so that I find myself now a storyteller. When I was in college, I immersed myself into the work of Joseph Campbell because of this excitement and the thrill of hearing stories and listen to Campbell try to lure us out of the cultural malaise of fundamentalism and literalism back into an experience of vast meaning when it comes to stories. One of my favorite quotes from Joseph Campbell. Campbell says that stories are the spiritual cartography for humanity. They're a map that guides us to life of meaning and purpose. And those guiding points, they're available to each of us, drawing us into the life that God made us for and that God intends us to live. Now, you scratch your heads in a church in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, on a Sunday morning, on the last Sunday of Easter, and you wonder why this guy is telling us about his grandfather's childhood and his own childhood. And I'm telling you this because our own experience of an interaction with this sacred story that we call the Easter story has been reduced and domesticated to such a way that we miss the revelation that shines through in such a powerful way. The church has so domesticated the story that we only expect two things from you. The first thing is like, did you get the plot and the character and the details? There was this guy, Jesus. He had an entourage that we call disciples. They have familiar names that carry into like white American history on this very day. How many John, Phillips, and Thomases are in the room right now? It's still happening. And oh, by the way, it was a time, an era of political upheaval. There was also a guy named Pilate. And there were these other characters who were somewhat nefarious. But if you have to only remember one thing, the only thing that you have to remember is that there was a body. And that body was not breathing. And then at some point, that body was breathing again. The church tells us that that's what we're supposed to remember. And then it only asks one more thing of us. One more thing. And man, this is a shame. It only asks, it's like, the church asks like, well, do you believe it? And if you do, well, good for you. Gold star. That is not what stories are for. Stories are for so much more than that. They're revelation. Do you hear in this story that we have for today, this story of ascension, where we hear it from the church's perspective, this flat, domesticated perspective? There was this guy named Jesus. He was resurrected. He spent about 50 days with these guys. And then whoosh, he went back up into the clouds. And those guys, they were kind of standing around like looking a little dopey, like what happened? And then somebody came, probably an angel, and said, you guys should get back to work. That's not it. That's not the story. It's not the story that we're meant to hear, and it's most certainly not the story that we're meant to live. Do you know that the cloud that Jesus went up into is the same cloud that Moses was given the Ten Commandments with God? Do you know it was the same cloud that Jesus was up on Mount Tabor, the Mount of Transfiguration, with Peter and James and John, where they saw him transfigured and they saw Moses and Elijah there? Same crowd. Do you see that there is more than meets the eye? Do you see that? How can you not see it here? You know, we could go to a lecture at Teton Science Schools. I'm not bashing on Teton Science Schools. We could go to a lecture on Teton Science Schools right now, and they could say, like, what an interesting plot on the timeline we find ourselves in right now. Winter turning to spring. there's such curious and wonderful things that happen. Plants that were brown and gray turn green. Animals that came down, migrated south, are now migrating north. Okay. But do you see? Do you see with your eyes that plants that were brown and gray are turning green? Do you know that those plants in turning green, those plants are feasting on sunlight? That's what turns them green and vital again. That this ball, this global mass that we are on, for some cosmic reason, this time of year, every single year, this time of year begins to list in a certain direction. This ball that I am told is on the outside, crust and dirt and rock, but on the inside is fire and molten lava, that this big, massy ball begins to list in a particular way so that it is oriented in a direction to a star. A star! One star of millions of stars. And just because we list this particular way, those plants begin to feast on the energy that is coming from this one star. Just while we're driving through the valley, this is happening. This church, this is revelation. This is a story of God's orientation to creation and all of us creatures, little old you and little old me. These plants are greening up, and these animals are migrating north, and these birds are returning to our valley just for you, Bill. Just for you, Mary. Glorious and ordinary, not ordinary. My administrative assistant, Chandler, and I asked Chandler if I could share this with the church. Chandler's a fifth generation Jacksonite, and Chandler, who does so much for this place and so much for me day in and day out, is pregnant. She's having a baby with her partner, Corey, and it is a beautiful thing. And we could tell that story. I could tell you that, like, Chandler met Corey a few years ago. Here they are in their mid to late 20s, coming together, doing what people do. Chandler landing a job here, Corey landing a job there, coming together, meeting and falling in love, which is a beautiful thing. And they came together in a brief and thrilling episode where Corey really didn't do an awful lot. But Chandler became pregnant in this beautiful moment. And then I could look at you and say, like, you know, guys, we should throw her a baby shower. They're going to need some stuff. And we would. We would come together. And we will. We'll come together and get them a crib and a changing table and a stroller, and we'll celebrate them, and we'll say to them in earnest, we are going to love this child as we love you. And that's a beautiful thing. Or I could tell you, like, a human being, a woman, is growing another human being in her abdomen because a brief and somewhat thrilling encounter with a man who does not have the capacity to do what Chandler is doing. It's nowhere near that. Her body, in such a mysterious and cosmic way, is forming another human being. And at some moment in time, her abdomen, her womb, which is a place of creation and life, her abdomen and womb will turn and will no longer be a place of creation and life. And then her body instinctively will begin contracting its muscles and pushing this new creature out of her womb, and will receive that baby and will give that baby a name. Maybe his name will be Philip or John or Thomas, or maybe his name will be Corey or Jimmy. Not Jimmy. Not Jimmy. Church, there is more than meets the eye. Revelation all around. All around. Don't hear what I am not saying. I don't mean to say that everything that happens in creation is good. I don't mean to say that my grandfather did not grow up in an environment that was violent and abusive and traumatic, and that that experience didn't hurt. I don't mean to say that. I don't mean to tell you from where I stand that life does not sometimes burn to the ground. It does. What I mean to say is that is not the story that we attend to. We attend to the story where there is more than meets the eye. We follow Campbell's spiritual cartography to a beautiful place where the dead are now alive again, even in the midst of confusion and frustration and pain. That is a part of the story. Even a part of the revealed story. But what I mean to say to you this morning, my brothers and sisters in Christ, do not listen to this story and leave this church unchanged. There is too much there. There is too much waiting for you to walk out of this place unchanged. The glorious revelation of the cosmos, which God has designed and created, is available to you this very morning through plot and character and connection and revelation and meaning and purpose and joy and blessing. Do not leave this church unchanged.